This is the BBC in Roseau, Dominica,
Montserrat,
the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.
O'clock GMT. These are the Caribbean news headlines on the BBC. I'm Bertram Niles. International rescue and relief teams have been arriving in Haiti to search for the many thousands of victims of Tuesday's devastating earthquake and bring help to survivors. The Caribbean is among countries preparing to send aid.
I have been authorized to send food, rice, flour, water, and also resources, cash resources.
The region is told it should be willing to accept an influx of Haitian migrants. And in an extended 10-minute edition of BBC Caribbean Report, a visit to a Haitian hospital.
Take the kids to the operation room and just start operating. I don't care how you does it, just get the kids and get in some medication and get it going, man.
That's in 5 minutes after the World News.
BBC News with Roy Lama. International rescue and relief teams have begun arriving in Haiti to search for the many thousands of victims of Tuesday's devastating earthquake and bring help to survivors. Aircraft bringing in rescue crews with specialist equipment as well as medical and food aid have been flying into the capital, Port-au-Prince. American and Chinese teams are among those to have arrived. International relief agencies are also at work in Haiti. A disaster management expert working for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Mark Cutts, said that a swift response to a disaster of this scale was crucial.
Every hour counts when people are trapped under rubble, and obviously the first 24 hours is the main window of opportunity that we have to extract people alive from the rubble. And so it's important to get teams in there as quickly as possible. We do have some emergency teams already on the ground. Some of them have heavy lifting equipment, but a lot more is needed. About 27 countries have offered urban search and rescue teams, and they're deploying at the moment. A lot are in the air as we speak. Some are on the ground. Others are arriving.
Rescue attempts so far have consisted largely of local people trying desperately to dig survivors out of the rubble. Estimates of the number of dead vary between tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands. People have spent a second night sleeping in the open, frightened of the continual aftershocks. Andy Gallagher is in the capital, Port-au-Prince.
Bodies just lying by the side of the road, some wrapped in white blankets, some just exposed. We went to a local hospital, and the sight there was simply heartbreaking. We pulled into the car park there, and there were many people being treated outside because lots of people here are afraid to go inside buildings. But in the hospital car park itself, it was simply strewn with bodies, bodies of men, women, and children. And in amongst those bodies, there were children sleeping, and these bodies are starting to rot now. The smell was pretty horrible, but the site itself was just devastating, and that was just a 20-minute drive from the compound here. And I think if that is replicated across the city, it gives you just some idea of what the situation here is like.
The International Red Cross has set up a special website to help Haitians find relatives they've lost contact with because of the earthquake. In New York, Haitians have been making donations. In Canada, the Governor General, Michelle Jean, who was born in Haiti, broke down in tears as she described the devastation.
It's time for us to show our solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Haiti, whose courage is once again being so harshly tested. And I want to say to them,
we shall not lose hope. And I was saying to the Haitian people that they are not alone.
BBC World News. President Chavez of Venezuela has reversed his decision to ration electricity in the capital, Caracas, although a program of power cuts will still apply to the rest of the country. He's also sacked the electrical energy minister. The moves follow an angry public reaction, especially in Caracas, to the energy rationing program announced on Wednesday to address a shortage of hydroelectric power. People complained it was not clear when the cuts would happen each day. Officials in northwest Pakistan say an American missile aimed at a hideout of the Pakistani Taliban leader, Hakimullah Massoud, has killed at least 12 suspected militants. It happened in the tribal region of North Waziristan, near Pakistan's border with Afghanistan. Ali Makbul reports from Islamabad.
A spokesman for the Pakistani Taliban's confirmed that Hakimullah Massoud had, until recently, been in the area. He claimed, though, that the Taliban leader had left before missiles struck what officials here are calling a militant training camp in Pakistan's tribal areas. There's no official confirmation of Hakimullah's death as yet, but he's certainly been one of Pakistan's key militant targets.
A court in Baghdad has sentenced 11 Iraqis to death for planning and carrying out multiple truck bombings last August, in which more than 100 people died. The attacks, which targeted the foreign and finance ministries, were the most deadly incidents in Iraq for more than a year. China says foreign internet firms acting within the law are welcome to do business there, a day after Google said it might pull out of the country because of hacking attacks and censorship. Questioned about Google, a Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman said the government was against any form of cyber attack. Google said on Tuesday it was no longer willing to censor results on its Chinese search engine to remove issues that Beijing deems politically sensitive. But it's now said it's still filtering its content. BBC News.
From London, this is BBC Caribbean Report.
The rescue effort in Haiti continues. Hello, I'm Bertram Niles with this specially extended edition of BBC Caribbean Report. Cargo planes from around the world are heading to Haiti, taking food, water, medical supplies, shelter and sniffer dogs for survivors of Tuesday's earthquake. The huge tremor flattened homes and workplaces, killing thousands of people and injuring many more. The sounds of chaos and desperation as dead survivors wander past bodies in the rubble-strewn streets of the capital, Port-au-Prince. Rescuers are continuing to search collapsed buildings for signs of life, as officials said the number of dead could run into tens of thousands. This man went looking for his parents.
That was my father's house, so we lose it. My mother was...
Now we have somebody here.
There's some person inside the house.
We can't find him. We don't have a loader to take them out.
And there's a special report direct from Haiti coming up in the second half of this 10-minute program. What's being described as a CARICOM mercy mission is due to fly today to Port-au-Prince for a first-hand assessment of the earthquake devastation. The mission is expected to include the current CARICOM chairman, Dominica's Prime Minister Roosevelt Skerrit, and his Barbados counterpart David Thompson. The announcement was made at an election campaign meeting in Bastia by the Prime Minister of St. Kitts and Nevis, Denzel Douglas. Dr. Douglas and the leader of the main opposition party in St. Kitts, Lindsey Grant, both interrupted campaigning for this month's vote to express their sadness at the events in Haiti. Also due to head to Port-au-Prince today is a delegation from Jamaica led by the Prime Minister, Bruce Golding. The Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Ralph Gonsalves, speaking after a cabinet meeting, said his country was gathering supplies and cash to send to Haiti.
I have been authorized to send food, rice, flour, water, and also resources, cash resources, to the government and people of Haiti. We are going to be working with the rest of CARICOM. I know CARICOM is mounting a particular initiative for support, but we are already starting to mobilize ourselves.
CARICOM's ambassador to Haiti, Earl Huntley, escaped the earthquake because he's currently on vacation in his native St. Lucia. He says Caribbean nations must be prepared to help any influx of migrants from Haiti, the newest member of the CARICOM single market.
One of the problems, in fact, we were having in our attempt to integrate Haiti into the CSME is that Haitians were saying, but look, you want us to be part of the region, but all the countries have visa restrictions against us. And how can you have, in a sense, second-class citizens in a community? So if it comes to that, yes, the region should help in that way. If not, we'll provide the housing, because definitely you will need the housing. I mean, a place like Guyana with the Greenheart, with the timber, we can help in that way.
The Caribbean is more likely to be buffeted by hurricanes, but what of earthquakes? Will more attention now be paid to the possibility of them occurring? One expert thinks so. More from Debbie Ransom.
Simon Young, who has worked in natural hazards risk assessment in the Caribbean for over a decade, predicts there will be a renewed focus on earthquakes in the region. Dr. Young has said that will be so particularly after a slow hurricane season last year. He said earthquakes do need to be on the Caribbean agenda all the time, but unfortunately it takes big events to bring the subject back to the forefront. The Caribbean region is indeed vulnerable to earthquakes. For example, the Seismic Research Unit of the University of the West Indies calls the Eastern Caribbean a seismic active area with hundreds of earthquakes occurring in and around the region each year. Not all of these are felt, however.
The government of Haiti will receive the maximum $8 million payout from its coverage with the Caribbean Catastrophe Risk Insurance Facility, the risk pooling scheme set up by Caribbean nations. That's because of the strength of the quake. Meanwhile, insurance companies say Haiti is woefully underinsured. Here's Mike Jarvis.
The California-based risk advisors Equicat said that while it can be challenging to estimate insurance risks in developing countries such as Haiti, it estimates the economic damages from this event to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Insurance coverage in the poverty-stricken country is said to be extremely low at about 0.3% of gross domestic product. According to a report from Risk Management Solutions, Haiti is one of the smallest insurance markets in the Americas, with total insurance other than life coverage of just under $20 million. As a result, the quake is unlikely to have much impact on the global insurance market.
BBC Caribbean News. For those listening on BBC FM or partner stations, staying with us, coming up, an extended report on the ground from Haiti. On the ground, people in Haiti are simply just coping as they await aid and supplies, none more so than at local hospitals. The BBC's Matthew Price has this report with some graphic descriptions.
Well, this is a particularly grim sight that we have been brought to now. This is the grounds of a hospital, one of Port-au-Prince's hospitals. There are people here wearing face masks because, to be honest, the stench is quite revolting. There are, I'm estimating, perhaps 100 bodies here, the bodies of adults, and then just at my feet here, the body of a baby. And perhaps even more uncomfortable than that is the fact that there are people in the grounds of this hospital bedding down for the night, sleeping amongst the dead here. There are some women sitting here inside an ambulance, and as you can hear, they're singing. Excuse me, sir. Can I ask for your name, please?
Yeah, my name is Nicolas.
Can you tell me, you're here with a member of your family. What happened?
Yeah, she was in a building. She was working at a radio station, and the building collapsed with her, and two legs are broken.
Is anybody able to help her? Is there any doctor?
No. Happily, her mother's a nurse, and it's her mother who's helping her, you know?
Her mother's helping her?
Yeah, it's helping her and helping other people also, because most of the doctors who are there, they can help, because they ain't got the proper materials, you know, to come and help to the people. So they are suffering.
Well, if it could get any more grim, it just has. I've walked into the hospital now and there are injured people lying all around, a handful of doctors trying to treat them, head injuries, people with broken legs, and amongst them, those who were brought in here injured and who have since died.
This is crazy. The house upstairs, there was upstairs, that's the one that fell on them. But the one downstairs, they are high.
And that killed your older daughter?
Yeah, that killed my last daughter. The house killed my last daughter, that was Brianna. And it kills her grandmother.
Hello? Hello? Ça va?
And now this daughter, her name is?
It's Talia, and she's fighting. Her legs, the bones came out. The bones came out, and the other feet's just hanging off. And her head just split from here to there.
Right the way over the top of the
over
skull.
Over the top of the skull. Just open. You know what I'm saying?
I see she's not got any medicine. She's not had any treatment to the head.
Treatment to the head. She haven't got no operation. I mean, just take her, the kids, to the operation room and just start operating. I don't care how you does it. Just get the kids and get in some medication and get it going, man. And a way to give her a life. Because she asking me for her sisters. I can't tell her her daughter, her last sister died.
Okay. Bobby.
I can't do nothing, man. I'm, you know, just God should have took my life too. You know, God should have taken my life. I can't do nothing, man.
There is a basic lack of infrastructure in this country which makes any sort of rescue attempt very, very difficult indeed. And so that those teams who are at this moment flying into the airport here, and I suppose one good thing is that the runway, I flew in on it just a few hours ago, that the runway is still operational, even if some of the buildings sustained damage during the earthquake. Those teams flying in are going to find a very different situation on the ground from the situation that they sometimes might face in other countries with perhaps a better infrastructure in place. It's going to be difficult for them to operate. They're used to operating in these difficult environments, but it looks pretty tough from what I've seen.
Matthew Price at the hospital in Port-au-Prince and in this specially expanded edition of BBC Caribbean Report. And there's continuing Haiti coverage on our website, bbccaribbean.com. Up next, sport with Chris Florence.
BBC Sports Caribbean, good morning from me, Chris Florence. We start with the cricket news, and Ricky Ponting and Michael Clarke both scored unbeaten centuries for Australia on the opening day of their third test against Pakistan in Hobart. They've put on 231 so far, Australia closing on 302 for three. Jim Maxwell was at the Bellarive Oval.
Pakistan paid dearly for dropping Ponting before he'd scored. Mohammad Amir spilt a straightforward chance at fine leg. Ponting marched on to his 39th test century, sharing a record unfinished partnership of 231 with Michael Clarke, who scored a chanceless 13th test 100. Pakistan had removed Katic for 11, Watson 29 and Hussey 6 to some disciplined pace bowling. Then Ponting and Clarke gained and wrested control. Ponting is 137, Clarke 111, Australia 3 for 302 at stumps.
We hope to get the latest from the Johannesburg Test match in a moment, but let's turn to football, and Liverpool are counting the cost of their defeat in the FA Cup in England. They lost 2-1 after extra time at home to Reading in their third round replay. It's their fifth home defeat in all competitions this season. So a hugely disappointing night for the Liverpool manager Rafa Benitez in the middle of what's becoming a depressing season.
I am not happy. I think we could play better. The result is really bad, so we have to be disappointed. And some things that I could see on the pitch, I didn't like.
Are we referring to decisions that went against Liverpool, including the penalty? Is that correct?
A lot of things, but, you know, we cannot change now the result, so we have to move forward, because I can be talking about a lot of things for a while.
And Reading will now play another Premier League side, Burnley, in the fourth round. In Spain, the holders Barcelona are out of the King's Cup. Despite beating Seville 1-0 in their second leg, they were eliminated on the away goals rule after the tie ended 2-2 on aggregate. And Juventus ended their poor run with a 3-0 home win over Napoli in the Italian Cup and now face a quarter-final against Inter Milan. Elsewhere, AC Milan were 2-1 winners over third division Novara. The former world boxing champion Ricky Hatton says he's making a comeback to finish his career at the top. In his last fight 8 months ago, Hatton was knocked out in the second round by the Filipino Manny Pacquiao. The severity of that defeat led many to urge him to retire, but Hatton says he's had plenty of support to continue.
I've sat down and I've listened to the people that are closest to me and the people who know Ricky Hatton best and the people that were close to me in the last training camp who know the circumstances and knew what happened in the last training camp. Those are the people I'm listening to, and they know what I'm capable of, and they know what I believe I've still got in me. And those are the people I've been listening to. It's very nice to hear people saying that you don't need to fight again, Ricky, you've proved yourself. And I suppose they are right, but as a fighter, you don't want your last fight to be like that. I want to finish at the top, and I know that my last training camp could have been better.
Some tennis news, and the world number one Serena Williams came from a set and 5-2 down to beat Aravani Rezai of France in the semi-finals of the Sydney Tennis International. Williams raised her game to take the semi-final in three sets, 3-6, 7-5, 6-4. She'll now meet Elena Dementieva in the final on Friday. Before we go, I can remind you that tell you, in fact, that England are 109-4 soon after lunch on the first day of the fourth and final test against South Africa in Johannesburg. They were in real deep trouble, 37-4 at one time. Paul Collingwood, though, is now 44 not out. Three of those wickets to Morning Morkel. And in Hobart, Australia reached 302-3 in their final test against Pakistan, that on the first day. And that's the latest from BBC Sports Caribbean.
And now our history programme witness. Late last year, Armenia and Turkey agreed to open their shared border for the first time since 1993, but the deal has yet to be ratified by the country's parliament. And there's still bad feeling between Armenia and Turkey surrounding the mass killings of hundreds of thousands of Armenians over 90 years ago. Tom Esselmont takes us a look back.
The year is 1915. The First World War has broken out, sparking chaos along Europe's southeastern perimeter. Thousands of Armenians living in the prosperous cotton fields in the region of Anatolia find themselves under attack from Ottoman Turks.
When the Turks came, first of all, they killed my father and my mother because they wanted to take our fields and everything.
Roza Khadaryan was 3 years old at the time. When this interview was recorded by the BBC 10 years ago, she still bore the scars of what she had lived through 84 years earlier. To her and other Armenians, the killings of hundreds of thousands of people can only be described as genocide.
They killed them and then they put my hand in the fire. Here it is, my hand in the fire.
The events which Armenia says led to the death of 1.5 million people and displacement of many more are complicated. Russia, France and Greece, among others, now recognise the killings as a calculated destruction of a people. To Turkey, they're part of the chaos of the First World War. Professor Ron Suni from the University of Michigan in the United States has studied the origins of the conflict. As he points out, prior to the killings, Armenians and Turks were actually friends, not enemies.
Ironically, in the middle of the 19th century, Armenians in the Ottoman Empire were known as the Millet Isadika, which means the loyal nation. But that began to change radically in the latter part of the 19th century as Armenians attempted to ameliorate their situation and were very interested in greater freedoms, greater rights, and even some autonomy within the bounds of the Ottoman Empire. Over time, the Turks began to imagine the Armenians as an internal enemy, as an existential threat to the survival of the empire.
Official Turkish historians have disputed the Armenian version of events. They say only 300,000 Armenians died and that the deaths were not organized executions, but simply the result of regional power play. However, Armenians and some international scholars write that women, children, and old men were systematically forced to leave their homes. Some fled to the south, to the deserts of Ottoman-controlled Syria. Certain historians suggest between 600,000 and 1 million people died on the way or when they got there. Others, like Yelena Abrahamyan, fled to the north, to Russian-controlled Armenia. She was 5 at the time. She's now nearly 100 years old. I met Yelena in her small apartment in the capital of Armenia, Yerevan. She's now an artist and her walls are adorned with colourful pictures of Anatolia.
We survived by a miracle. At that time, thousands of people were fleeing to the Armenian town of Gyumri. Since my father was with the military, we were provided with a van. We put all of our things into the van. Soon, word spread that some Armenians were already on the way to Gyumri. Then the Turks approached. I quickly hurried home and people were saying, let's hurry and go to Gyumri as well.
Gyumri was a town in the Russian province of Armenia that many eventually fled to. Sadly, when they got there, many more died because it was a land of sort of walking pestilence and death. There were no possibilities for real health care. People died of typhus and of other diseases of starvation.
As Professor Sunni explains, the relative safety of Russia didn't guarantee survival. Yelena remembers people's attempts to escape. Although 90 years on, her memory is patchy, she still recalls the awful things that she saw along the road.
The Turks went to the mountains and started shooting at people, but the people fleeing were mainly women and children. The road followed alongside a river. There was another road which was full of people, but because of the Turks, it was impossible to use it. I remember a bridge. It was called Fear Bridge because it was very vulnerable. People tried to cross it, but as they did so, it collapsed.
Did you lose friends?
The first dead person I saw was a man who was trying to escape and was suddenly shot. A woman witnessed it and started to scream and cry. I remember her screaming. It was very, very noisy. But I don't remember everything that was going on. That's because at that point I fell unconscious.
How many of your friends and family did you lose?
I saw my grandmother take care of my cousin. She was 4 years old. She was wounded. But in substance, my memory of those events is quite patchy because I was left alone in the van. I was unconscious. I'm not sure how long for. But then I opened my eyes and saw my cousin next to me. I can still remember to this day how still she looked. When I spoke to her, she gave no reaction. There was no reflex.
Both Rosa's and Yelena's childhood memories paint a picture of chaos during the period from 1915 to 18. Their stories and others like them have been passed on to the next generation. But events seen by Armenians as genocide are less widely known than the Jewish Holocaust of the Second World War. Professor Sunni thinks he knows why that might be the case.
The Armenian genocide is very much different from the Jewish Holocaust by the Nazis in that, unlike the Holocaust, it's not a kind of sterile, bureaucratic, organized event. The genocide was much more disorganized, in some ways spontaneous violence or arbitrary violence took place. And Rosa's account of the burning of her hand is typical of many of the atrocities that people report that have come down to us in diaries, memoirs, letters, etc. People have told tales of women being disemboweled, pregnant women, the fetuses thrown into the ground or into a river. People were so traumatized by the physical brutalities, the rapes, the murder of children, bashing children's heads against rocks, that many women and others threw themselves into the Euphrates to commit suicide. It's said that the river, the Euphrates, ran red with blood.
It's graphic images like those described by Professor Sunni which still haunt Yelena.
When I close my eyes, I see everything like a coloured film. Every night, I relive those experiences. For a short time after I was displaced, I went to an orphanage. That didn't help. The orphanage was headed by a military official. I was unhappy. I'm still so unhappy.
So there's not one bit of you that's prepared to forgive and move on?
No. Turkey should first recognize genocide, apologize. Otherwise, my heart won't stand it.
Rosa was also orphaned, but she turned to her Christian faith to help her overcome the sense of loss and pain.
I was taken to the orphanage, and there I was brought up. I have a Bible they gave me as a present. Still, I've got the Bible with me. Oh, we suffered very much. What can I do? What is the good of being angry? God forgive them. I can't say anything. God says, vengeance is mine. I shall punish them.
Today, nearly 95 years after the events described by Rosa and Yelena, the Turkish government still refuses to see the mass killings and displacements as genocide. And soon, no eyewitnesses to the events of 1915 to 18 will be left alive.
Witness was written and presented by Tom Esselmont.
BBC. dawn in the Amazon rainforest, and even through the early morning mist, the scars of deforestation can be seen.
I'm Gary Duffy in the city of Sao Paulo in Brazil. Brazil really is an extraordinary country to report from. Of course, it's home to the Amazon, this huge tropical rainforest that is so vital to our planet. But it's more than that. These days, Brazil is often called an agricultural superpower, while major new oil finds have been made off the coast.
Whether you want breaking news, insight analysis, or stories behind the headlines, the BBC's global network of correspondents ensures you get the complete picture from every angle.
BBC News, Sydney,
Swat Valley,
Colombo,
Kabul.
Next week, Barack Obama will miss his own deadline for the closure of the Guantanamo prison camp. Assignment looks at what went wrong. Today at 9 a.m. Eastern.